Okay, hello. So I work on a popular serial called The Mysteries of London, which until recently received quite very little serious critical attention. So in this paper, I'm going to examine some reasons why that might be and suggest that it reflects an attitude to the mysteries readership, which itself has roots in the mid-19th century and which involves undervaluing the capabilities of the young, working class and frequently female readership, which Reynolds' serial addressed. So that's kind of well enough in the 19th century, but the fact that the view of Reynolds, which that kind of provoked, has been sustained for so long, I find perplexing, particularly given that the mysteries itself seems to anticipate and to challenge this perspective, portraying the period's developing censorship discourse as a deliberate strategy of cultural hegemony, calculated to maintain the supremacy of a traditional educated elite by denying a disempowered class of vulnerable readers a full cultural understanding. Reynolds challenges the assumptions that underpin that discourse with a series of dynamic and sexually confident heroines whose control over their own representation allows them to manipulate the men who come to watch them. So to start off with some background about the text I'm going to talk about. So this is George Reynolds, The Mysteries of London was his most successful novel. He wrote about 70 novels. He's also a journalist. He edited a journal and a newspaper. And The Mysteries was published as a serial between the years 1844 and 1856. I find it really exciting to work on because this is effectively kind of the birth of mass culture. It's the 1820s and 30s that you have technological developments in the production of paper and in printing, which make it possible for the first time to mass produce kind of printed material at a price which is affordable for the working class. So his serials were published in weekly 8-page instalments, which cost a penny each, so it's affordable. His work is politically radical, so he's involved in the Chartist movement, which agitated for working class folks, and he was a Republican. He was campaigned against the aristocracy. It's also, as I'm going to discuss in more detail, much more sexually open than most of the canonical literature from the period. At the same time, as this extract from the Bookseller magazine suggests, it reached an audience of unprecedented size. So it says Dickens had thousands of readers, but Mr. Reynolds' readers were numbered by hundreds of thousands, perhaps by millions. So this is a whole new kind of audience. It's a completely different scale. So all of these factors together, the political radicalism, the sexual openness, and this enormous audience, meant that for kind of the literary establishment of the period, the mysteries became kind of a worst-case example of what popular literature might be. People were really afraid of it. They disapproved of it. So Reynolds was very successful, but he was never respectable. So this is Dickens writing to one of his friends, and he says, Reynolds is a name with which no ladies and no gentlemen should be associated. Now, there's a kind of personal rivalry going on here, which I won't go into, but it's quite representative. So, for example, that's 1849. Reynolds died in 1879, 30 years later, but you find that there's no obituary published for him in the Times. The only place that they publish it is the Bookseller, which is the trade magazine. They don't usually publish obituaries, but they do publish quite a long obituary of Reynolds, and they say that is because no notice of his death has appeared in the Times or the Athenaeum. So the respectable papers won't even mention the fact that he's died. They're not going to devote any space to him, even after after the fact. So that's the 19th century, but what I find particularly interesting is that you still find modern literary critics saying something quite similar. So this is Walter Kendrick. He talks about Reynolds' work as potboilers, not intended to be literature. Jonathan Rose says it's sensational trash verging on pornography. I could have included other examples, but I thought these ones are particularly interesting because these are kind of you'd expect this to be sympathetic context. So Walter Kendrick is writing about the history of 19th century pornography. Jonathan Rose is writing about working class literacy. And yet even these critics who you think should be kind of on board with Reynolds, they don't approve of him. So that's kind of, I want to explore in this paper why that might be. To me, this seems like this is a hangover from the 19th century, effectively, and people aren't paying proper attention to what Reynolds is actually doing. I think also the fact that The Mysteries is a 12 years weekly serial, it's really massive. People don't really read it. People just look at the pictures of it. People read little bits of it. I think people don't necessarily, and the pictures aren't, the pictures might give you like a different impression. So you kind of there's an illustration every 8 pages in The Mysteries of London. Some of them are just illustrating what's happened, but you get from about the third series onwards these kind of pin-up pictures as well, kind of like sexy ladies with low-cut dresses on. These are the heroines, and they're kind of portrayed in this way that you can imagine kind of the guys that are reading it, like sticking it on their bedroom walls, like, do you know, I think there's like a similarity happening. It's a particular kind of model of womanhood. You know, they're kind of passive. They all have these kind of uniform features. They have these big eyes, really big boobs. He loves to write about the breasts and their kind of spherical breasts. and sort of the cascading hair, all of this. So it's a kind of reductive, kind of the women are passive. And if that was the only kind of erotic material that you found in the Mysteries of London, I would think there was, you know, fair enough maybe if people were critical of it. But actually, if you start to look at the stories, the narrative material is much more interesting. So I just want to start off by kind of recounting in brief one of the very, very many plot lines which you find in the story. So this is Cecilia Harborough. She's an aristocrat. She's separated from her husband, and she decides that she really wants to woo Reginald Tracy, who's a very good-looking vicar. And sadly, he's vowed to a life of celibacy. But she kind of tries to seduce him. It takes about 3 days before he's persuaded. They kind of have sex, and then he starts to feel bad about it, and he says, no, I can never see you again. So she thinks, right, how can I get him back? So this is her strategy. She disguises herself as a classical kind of nude statue. She has an old woman sort of install her in her house and summon Tracy to come and look at it, and it works very well. So he's sort of looking at her, he's like, this statue is really hot. This is amazing. And then he thinks, it looks kind of like Cecilia. So then he says, yes, there is something more than senseless marble here. The eyes shoot fire, the lips smile, the bosom heaves. Oh, Cecilia, Cecilia, it is yourself. It was indeed the beauteous but wily Cecilia, who returned his embrace and hung around his neck, and the rector was again subdued, again enslaved. And that's kind of it. After that, they just had this full-blown affair. So this is one of very many seduction scenes in The Mysteries of London, and it's quite typical in that the woman is the one seducing the man, which is interesting in itself. If you have men don't really tend to persuade women, they just take advantage of them by force, which is, you know, less subtle. So it's interesting in itself because these heroines are much more dynamic. If you think of the heroines in Dickens novels, they tend to be much sort of teenage, sort of doll women that don't really do very much often. But I think this specific example is particularly interesting, and that's kind of what I want to unpack during this talk. You often find in Reynolds these storylines which seem sort of insane and very exaggerated, but then if you start to think about them kind of, you know, if it was a realist writer talking about this as a metaphor instead of literalising it, you can see that it's exploring something more complicated. So that's kind of what I want to talk about. I now want to introduce some of that, what Reynolds is reacting against. So Reynolds' work is part of this new kind of popular fiction, this big flood of cheap publications which is coming onto the marketplace, mostly in a short period in the early 1840s, really. It starts to appear suddenly, like loads and loads of penny journals that are aimed at the working class suddenly appearing all at once. And the people who are kind of traditional literary elite become quite anxious about it because they're used to kind of being in control of what's produced. They understand everything that's coming out. They know who's reading what. And so then they're suddenly like, all this stuff which they don't really understand, they don't really have, it's not their taste. It seems quite kind of sensational. They don't know what the effect is going to be on all these working class readers. They start to think of something of like dangerous is going to happen. So one of the ways that they respond is to try and regulate the marketplace. And one of the ways that that happens is through censorship legislation. So 1857, which is the year after The Mysteries of London was sort of finished, Parliament passed the Obscene Publications Act. So that was mostly put through under the aegis of the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Campbell. And this quotation comes from when he first introduces the idea for this legislation. And he does it with kind of pleasing metaphorical sensibility during a parliamentary debate about the sale of poisons. So that's what everyone's talking about in Parliament. He's like, oh, guys, by the way, while we're talking about poison, he says, from a trial which had taken place before him on Sunday, he'd learned with horror and alarm that a sale of poison more deadly than prussic acid, strychnine or arsenic, the sale of obscene publications and indecent books, was openly going on. But what's particularly interesting here is it's not just about the fact that it's about the sale and who they're being sold to. So he says, it was not alone indecent books of a high price, which is a sort of check, that were sold, but periodical papers of the most licentious and disgusting description were coming out week by week and sold to any person who asked for them, and in any numbers. So he's referring to the weekly serial, which is absolutely associated with the penny literature market. You know, that's the kind of the stereotypical format that the penny, you know, penny papers would come out in. So it's very specific kind of literature he's referring to. So it's not the fact that people are publishing pornography, it's the fact that working class people are able to access it cheaply at will. It's not just, you know, posh people who are able to read it. And this idea of the relationship between obscenity and audience, you know, whether or not something is obscene depends on who's reading it, is sort of it further enshrined in law in a judgment which was made in 1868 by Alexander Cockburn, who's the successor to Lord Campbell as the Lord Chief Justice. It's called the Hicklin Rule, and this is used even today when people are doing trials in this country to do with obscene material. This is the definition of what's obscene. Printed material can be considered obscene if its tendency is to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to such immoral influences and into whose hands a publication of this sort may fall. So the question of who is likely to read it and how they're likely to respond to it is absolutely like essential to what pornography is. Who are these audiences which are open to such immoral influences? Well, of course, it's young people, poor people and women. W.G. Gregg, this is an article from 1859. This is one of the reasons people are worried about these particular categories of readers. This is the kind of a stereotypical view of these readers. So he says, women who are always impressionable, in whom at all times the emotional element is more awake and more powerful than the critical, whose feelings are more easily aroused and whose estimates are more easily influenced than ours. So this is talking about women, but it's exactly the same attitude which people have to working class readers as well. It's this idea that they're much more emotionally kind of open and vulnerable. They're not able to be kind of dispassionate critics. So they're vulnerable and they're also potentially volatile. Walter Kendrick, who I cited earlier having a go at Reynolds, writes a really interesting book, The Secret Museum, and he talks in that about the fact, the way in which this idea of audience is enshrined in the whole word, the very word pornography. So pornography, it's a Greek word, it literally means writing about prostitutes, and before the 19th century it just is usually used to refer to scientific writing about, you know, the prostitution problem or whatever. So it only acquires its modern meaning of sort of obscene materials in the 19th century, and it acquires that meaning in the context of Pompeii, of the erotic artifacts which people dug up at Pompeii. This kind of thing. It was in the late 18th century that Pompeii is rediscovered, that people are excavating it throughout the 19th century, and the archaeologists are kind of troubled by this kind of thing, which sort of contradicts Victorian notions about the Romans being very sort of civilised, very sophisticated. Also, as archaeologists, you know, they want to preserve this material, but they're worried about sort of displaying it openly. They don't want people to get the wrong idea. So what happens, as Kendrick discusses, is that you have a separate room at the Naples Museum where the Pompeii artefacts are displayed, and the room is only accessible to wealthy male visitors. You have to pay to enter, you have to be a man. So it's kind of, you know, Kendrick talks about this as the kind of literal realisation of this segregation of readerships, of the idea, you know, some people are able to look at certain heads of material which isn't suitable for other readers. He cites a French archaeologist called M.L. Barret, who is talking about the way that, you know, these male scientific visitors are able to look at this kind of thing. So he says, in the exercise of his holy office, the man of science must neither blush nor smile. We have looked upon our statues as an anatomist contemplates his cadavers. So this is the ideal. This is the male reader, you know, kind of idealised, scientifically detached. He can look at all these naked women, people having sex, men with enormous penises, and he just feels cool about it. So there's this kind of, it's this distinction between kind of emotionally vulnerable female working class adolescent readers and scientifically detached, kind of clinical, judgmental male readers, that's the basis for the whole notion of the obscene publications, like for the idea that there's one class which is qualified to censor or filter out material which that can then be presented to the others. And it's really interesting to think about that in the context of Reynolds' work, because his primary readership is precisely the group identified as vulnerable readers. So I already talked about the way that the mysteries is aimed at working class readers, but it was also identified with a female readership. So the bookseller, which I already cited, the same obituary which I already cited, they talk about the half-educated girls by whom his novels are principally patronised. And Abel Hayward, who's a Manchester newspaper seller, so he's selling the Mysteries of the Court of London in Manchester. He says a great many females read The Court of London, which is another name for the Mysteries of London. You can see it in the phrase half-educated girls. It's, you know, young, they're working class, half-educated, they're female. This is everything that the vulnerable reader, you know, embodies the vulnerable reader. And yet, what he's selling them is material which is identified as kind of erotic, sexual, so that's kind of a big problem. The female interest in Reynolds' work is a particular problem because the fact that women were interested in reading the Mysteries of London kind of helped to expose a contradiction in the way that women readers were depicted. So this is a critic called Nina Bain, and she's talking about American novels. So she says, female taste was supposed to reflect a fastidious delicacy. So women were supposed to, you know, the ideal woman wasn't supposed to be interested in any of this stuff anyway. But this view implies a very different reader from the excitable, impressionable, sensually vulnerable youth for whose innocence the reviewers were so much concerned. Yet, since half or more of the novel reading youth were females, these two imagined readers must be identical. So you have, on the one hand, people saying, oh, well, you know, women are really pure and innocent, they wouldn't enjoy this kind of thing anyway. On the other hand, they're saying, we must stop women reading this. You know, so there's kind of a contradiction there. You know, do women enjoy this kind of thing or do they not enjoy it? Why, what sort of, what does that imply about the realities of what women are? And you can see people wrestling with this difficulty in the way that they talk about Reynolds' work. Commentators kind of tie themselves in knots trying to explain how women who should be reviled by sexual material might be attracted by Reynolds' work. And the solution that they most frequently come up with is to say that Reynolds is somehow disguising the obscenity of his work, that it's masquerading as more respectable than it is. So you have this guy, Dr. Sanger, he says, he writes in a strain eminently calculated to excite the passions, but so carefully guarded as to avoid absolute obscenity, and embellishes his work with woodcuts, those are the pictures we just looked at, which approach lasciviousness as nearly as possible without being indictable. So this idea, he's kind of walking the line, and that he's doing this to be deceptive, that he's kind of luring in his like vulnerable readerships by pretending that he's not doing anything wrong, but really it's super corrupt. So this is important, I think, because it actually helps to shore up the case for censorship, because to say that it's difficult to know what's pornographic makes it even more imperative that you have a kind of elite class which is monitoring it for you. You know, if you're kind of a working class female reader, you don't know if you're allowed to read this or not. You need somebody to tell you if it's okay for you to read it. So characterising Reynolds as tricksy, I'd say, strengthens the demand for an expert to combat him, disempowering the reader who might wish to think for herself. So with all of this in mind, I want to go back to Reynolds, who actually explicitly addresses this issue, I would argue, in The Mysteries of London. So this is a scene from the fourth series in which the heroine, Venetia Trelawney, here she is, has been lured to the house of a suitor, the Marquis of Leveson. She finds herself, the Marquis of Leveson, she finds herself in a gallery filled with pictures and statues. To start with, it all looks very innocent, but very soon she finds herself feeling like something is wrong. And it turns out the gallery is revealed as part of an elaborate strategy used by the Marquis to excite his female visitors into a state of sexual arousal and vulnerability. So it's like a secret pornographic gallery, which doesn't seem like it's pornographic, but then they sort of leave them in there and then they suddenly become corrupted by all the sexy works around them. And then he can like pounce, that's the idea. So he does this with art which both excites and deceives, which seems to be innocuous but is actually dangerously erotic. So this is a statue of Mars and Venus. It says, as a specimen of art, the design and execution were inimitable, but the beauty of the goddess of love was so intimately blended with an expression of wantonness that the very effigy appeared to glow and palpitate as if ready to burst into the ardour of ungovernable passion. But still there was nothing that could possibly shock or disgust the female mind. So it's sort of this seesawing between, is it filthy or is it okay? Which it's exactly, you know, it's such a clear echo of the way that people are talking about Reynolds himself. So it seems to me that he's explicitly addressing this idea about a kind of ambiguity of a pornography that pretends not to be pornographic. But what's interesting is that instead of in the context of cheap street literature, this is in the context of kind of classical artworks in the home of an aristocrat. And he's an aristocrat that's using this material in a very calculated way. So he's relying on his own kind of greater cultural knowledge to be able to manipulate Venetia, the heroine, who's vulnerable because she doesn't have the same knowledge. She isn't able, the idea is, that to recognise what's wrong and what's right. That's how he thinks that he can get his female victims. So I want then to suggest that this scene with Venetia in Leveson's kind of pornographic gallery might act as a comparison to Kendrick's idea of the secret museum at Pompeii, So that we remember acts as a model for Lord Chief Justice Campbell's solution to cheap pornography. So he's got this censorship legislation. He wants to hide away certain things, you know, to have this elite class which is in charge. This you can't look at, this you can look at. And that's supposed to be sort of helpful to this endangered class of vulnerable readers. Venetia's experience challenges this assumption. Rather than protecting the vulnerable, Leveson's museum reinforces his malevolent power, demonstrating the dangers of a class-based cultural monopoly. So this is, he's saying, this is what happens. You're very vulnerable, you're open to manipulation if you allow other people to kind of let you know what you can see and can't see. So at this point, I want to go back to Cecilia, who we began with. I'd say that her story completes Renoir's challenge to the status quo. So Venetia's story offers a critique of the present situation, as Renoir saw it, arguing that it's ignorance rather than natural inaptitude, which might make women, and by extension the working class, less sophisticated readers. Cecilia's narrative goes further still, suggesting that the men who pride themselves on their reading ability, their dispassionate nature, you know, the fact that they can look at these statues and not feel anything, are actually just as emotionally and sexually vulnerable as the women whom they claim a right to protect. And furthermore, he suggests that these objectified women, if they were granted proper cultural literacy, might actually find themselves in a position of power. So to go back to the scene, this is just before the extract I gave before, where Reginald sees statue Cecilia. So he's in this old woman's house, he sees the statue, he thinks, oh, this is great. So he says, so lost in wonder at the success with which the sculptor had performed his work and experiencing feelings of a soft and voluptuous nature, Reginald drew closer to the statue. So this is, if you compare this to what Barre is saying about, you know, we contemplate other statues like the anatomist contemplates his cadavers, this is not the way that he's supposed to be reacting. You know, he should be like, oh yes, a very fine statue, well, great craftsmanship, but he experiences feelings of a soft and voluptuous nature, which is particularly interesting because she's framed as this classical statue. So his failure to live up to this standard challenges the notion of the male reader's detachment. Moreover, I'd suggest his arousal at the sight of this kind of classically framed body suggests, as does Leveson's exploitation of his own fine art in the pornographic gallery, that the same erotic ambiguity for which Reynolds' work was criticised is inherent even in the most canonical, respectable representations of female bodies. Is the same contradictory ideal applied to the Victorian women, with this tension between exterior modesty and internal sexual depravity? You know, he's suggesting that actually this is something which men kind of like. They, you know, it's kind of exciting, this sort of tension between surface and interior. And it's Cecilia's understanding of the way that women are viewed which lets her manipulate him. So she knows that if she poses in this way, it's going to have an effect on him. She knows that he doesn't look at her dispassionately, coldly. She knows that that's going to be a good strategy. So I'd argue that it's her cultural literacy, her understanding of the way that women are depicted and looked at, that empowers her. So for me, this is an argument that Reynolds is making about his own project as a writer for the working classes. She's not the only heroine, far from the only heroine in the series, who kind of behaves in this way, who represents herself in the language of art, in a vernacular of art. So, you know, women who have portraits painted of themselves, women who kind of pose, in, you know, who are involved in kind of charades and, you know, amateur dramatics, all of these things. And they do it to manipulate men in the way that Leveson, in the gallery scene, tries to manipulate Venetia. As I suggest, it's a trope with obvious implications in the context of Reynolds' own work, which sought to bring taboo subjects before an audience elsewhere identified as vulnerable and in need of protection, suggesting to all of his so-called vulnerable readers that a monopoly on culture means a monopoly on power. Reynolds tells them that developing your cultural literacy is a route to reappropriating both your image and your authority from those who have traditionally dictated what you are able to see.